You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Ravi Shankar about his essay, The Five-Room Box, which appeared in issue 21 of The Common. Ravi Shankar is a Pushcart Prize-winning poet, translator, and professor. He has published 15 books, including W.W. Norton's Language for a New Century, Recent Works Press's The Many Uses of Mint, and the Muse India Award-winning Tamil translation, The Autobiography of a Goddess. He has taught and performed around the world and appeared in such venues as the New York Times, NPR, the BBC, and PBS NewsHour. He received his PhD from the University of Sydney, and his memoir, Correctional, is out this fall from University of Wisconsin Press. Ravi Shankar, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Emily.
We always like to start off by setting the scene, so I wonder if you could tell us where you're calling from and describe to us a little about what it's like there.
Sure. So I just finished this fellowship at the University of Sydney, so parts of the last couple of years I was in Australia, and I just finally relocated back to New England, and I'm in Providence, Rhode Island, actually in Cranston, right on the Providence-Cranston border. And my partner and I have a little office that's kind of, our place is close to Roger Williams Park on one side and the water on another. And so that's where I'm speaking to you from.
That sounds really nice. I had a friend who lived in Cranston for a little while. It's very nice down there, yeah.
Yeah.
Would you read the first few paragraphs of your essay for us, sort of as a little introduction?
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks.
So this is the five-room box, and it's in five sections, and I'll just read the first couple of paragraphs of section one. Tomorrow is Amma's 70th birthday, and I'm wondering what to buy her. She's told me that the only thing she wants from her children is a new toilet seat, a pair of sensible black shoes, or a replacement floor mat for her decade-old Honda Civic. None of those gifts seem particularly appropriate to such a consequential birthday, but then again, Amma's always been practical. When she tells the story of her arranged marriage to my father at 19, a decade younger than this man she had only met once before, she recalls bringing a griddle, and leaving behind stamp albums as she embarked upon a permanent journey from her home in Coimbatore, South India to Northern Virginia. Though she would never see it this way, my mother's is the story of a woman born into a patriarchal society, considered property and consigned to do the bidding of men. By all accounts, including her own, she had been blessed with an ideal childhood. After Madras, Coimbatore is the second largest city in Tamil Nadu, a place sometimes referred to as the Manchester of South India because of its many factories and industrial heritage, but also with a slightly derisive edge. Nearly half the motors, water pumps, and wet grinders in India are manufactured in this city, the little of the music or culture of its British counterpart.
Thanks for reading that. Would you describe what the piece is about just for our listeners who might not have read it yet?
Yeah, it's a piece that reflects on my parents and my mother in particular and her immigration to the U.S. in the late 1960s. But it's also very much a piece about identity. And though I was born in Washington, D.C., during the middle of my third grade year, we uprooted to take care of my grandmother who had cancer. And I spent a year of the formative years of my childhood in Madras. And so it's about that time. And it's juxtaposing my parents' migration story with my own sense of displacement being a young boy and what it kind of meant to me as a man today.
Thank you. So I know this is excerpted from your memoir, but I was wondering if you could tell us how you came to write this piece specifically or this specific part of the memoir, like what inspired it, how it came together.
Sure. And this is where I have to credit a really wonderful editor is a rare thing. And so the Commons, Jennifer Acker, is terrific. And we met and I had this chapter in the memoir that is about some of these experiences. And I shared it with her. And she thought that it could be recast into a discrete essay. And so the piece here is actually a significantly different. I've turned it into five parts. And I should just mention that the name of the essay, The Five Room Box, comes from a Tamil phrase, the Anjari Petti, which is many households will have. And it's just a little container that you keep your spices in, usually has five compartments and different spices for your Indian cooking, your masala and turmeric and all of these things. So I decided to put this essay into five sections. And then I also had to think about finding a closure with it. So it's discrete. In the context of my memoir, it's telling this larger story of my family history. And I wanted to distill it a little bit in this particular piece.
That's really interesting to hear. I think we don't talk very often about, you know, what it's like to craft an excerpt from a larger work that would fit on its own and stand on its own. And I guess, yeah, I guess I didn't know that you and Jen had worked that much that extensively on it. Do you want to say anything else about sort of how that piece came together? Like, was it very difficult? Did it come together easily?
Well, I think when Jen and I had our initial conversation, I looked to recast it a little bit. And I actually ended up taking portions from different chapters in the memoir. To make this particular essay. And, I often think about form and the fact that there was this object, this artifact that my mother still has lent itself very naturally to the pacing of the essay. And then I thought, okay, I have these five sections and I can move temporally and kind of ideologically through different issues by using this form. And so that really helped as well. And then, of course, Jen's feedback helped me really kind of craft it and hone it.
That's very interesting. That process of sort of pulling together separate parts sounds challenging, but also, you know, very much like putting together a puzzle or something like that.
Yeah, I like that.
So I know this is your first book of prose after a very long, successful career as a poet. Did you find any specific challenges of sort of switching gears from poetry to prose?
Oh, yes. Wow. I mean, this correctional has been, you know, about 7 years in the making, probably. And, as a poet, I think I'm very interested in language, but particularly the sonic and imagistic qualities. And as a prose writer, I felt I had to pare that back and to grapple with the larger contrivances of plot and character development and dialogue. And all the while, I'm mining the actuality of what happened and writing about people who might not particularly want to be written about. I mean, this terrain was totally new for me as a poet. You know, I've written poems about people, but usually they're kind of too encoded for them to ever.
Yeah.
say. But in this case, I did publish some other excerpts as op-eds, and that gave me a sense of what I could include, but it really did take a lot of crafting and many drafts and feedback from many trusted people. And every time I thought I was done, there was another excruciating layer of unpeeling that had to happen. And I guess, you know, for me at least, as you get closer to the areas where you really don't want to speak about something or it feels really vulnerable and painful, that's really where the heart of the story is.
Yeah, it's true. That is where the magic happens, but it's very easy to avoid until you really, really have to do it.
Yes, exactly.
So we heard from the part you just read a few minutes ago that this piece sort of starts out with an exploration of your mother's experience as a young woman and then sort of suddenly a young bride married to someone she doesn't really know and moving suddenly to America. And from there, the essay, you know, as you say, it covers a lot of different topics sort of pieced together. And it includes your own personal experiences as a boy in India and in America. I'm wondering, like, do you have a sense of why your mother seemed like the right starting place for a piece that's covering all these different things?
Yeah, so I think right around the time that I was kind of editing it, it was in fact my mother's 70th birthday, and she figures pretty prominently in this book. And, you know, much of this book is about choice, conscious choice, but also when fate is predetermined in some way. And my mother's story, I mean, she's really kind of an exceptional, lively woman, but she really had to kind of do things that she didn't necessarily want to do because of the society she was born in. And that felt to me like a nice vehicle to explore my own identity, where I have had a lot of choice, but I've also made a lot of mistakes. And how did I come to do that? I thought my mother would be a good vehicle to enter into that.
Yeah, I get such a great sense of your mother from reading this essay, the experience when she's in India and sort of helps you with sort of a bully or a conflict at school. I thought she really, really came out of that situation.
Yeah, you know, she's such a gregarious person. She was just visiting, in fact, and she will just talk to anyone. It doesn't matter. And she just has a kind of warmth about her, but she also is fiercely protective, as a mother is. And so, yeah, in the essay, I have the little moment where she has me return this bag that's a little kid had stolen from me. And, you know, I think that there's just a certain bite to that gesture that it's only in retrospect that I even realize.
Yeah, that is the beauty of writing about childhood too, is understanding a lot more about it the second time. So as you probably know, The Common publishes work with a modern sense of place. That's our focus. And this piece is certainly very transporting, since a huge portion of it takes place in India when you're visiting as a boy. And you write about it very beautifully. But this piece also creates a very interesting sort of liminal place in the in-between, you know, where this young boy is never fully at home. He's not Indian enough in India. He's not American enough in America. Can you talk about what it was like to write those experiences of being sort of always in between?
Yeah, I think this is a feeling that many, particularly you know, first generation immigrant children have, where your family is still clinging to some vestige of what the life was like in the old country, and yet you're trying to assimilate and fit in and be American, and that conflict that it creates can be disconcerting and even traumatic at moments. And, you know, I think I owe part of becoming a writer to that experience, because when you do feel like you don't fit in to either place. And, you know, I write about in this essay, when I go to India, the kids around me say I sound like John Wayne. And it's like, what? What are you talking about? So for the first time, I felt really American. And yet here I was in India. And but so to navigate that space makes you more of an observer, at least me. And so I think I just kind of slowed down, and I kind of realized. And now I feel really lucky to have had these two heritages to draw from when it comes to my identity. But growing up, it was, you know, pretty excruciating, because you just want to be, you know, a normal kid, one of the guys. And I do think going to India for that year made the connection I had to my heritage that much more palpable. And I think that's probably why I still have this pretty strong connection to India today.
Yeah, there's a really nice part in the essay where you talk about how sort of like coming back to America after having been in India so long, you feel like it could be a good thing that you have this other identity, as opposed to like a negative thing, you know, like that it's a bit of a superpower or something like that, that you have more about you than the other students, you know about or see.
Yeah. And, you know, it was something to take solace in, especially, and, you know, I think young kids are always cruel, but to feel kind of excluded. And, you know, I certainly had my fair share of racist comments and things when I was a young kid. And so, In the secrecy of my own mind and home, I felt, okay, well, I have this other dimension of knowledge and experience that these kids don't. And so I can kind of forgive them their limited perspective. But, you know, it made me feel like, okay, there's something greater out there than what I see around me.
Absolutely. I would love to talk a little more about your memoir, Correctional, which is coming out this fall. And it's about time you spent in jail after violating probation. And in a piece for the Marshall Project, you wrote, "Nothing made me feel more American than being incarcerated." I would love to hear more about that idea.
Well, yeah. So Correctional, this piece in the Common is, a part of the narrative, but kind of atypical, because the kernel of that, the story of that memoir, in fact, is 90 days that I had to spend at Hartford Correctional on nearly a decade ago. And this was for, it begins with a stop and frisk that I had in New York that I was totally innocent of, and when I got racially profiled and arrested on an erroneous warrant. And I talk about that experience. And then later, as a professor in Connecticut, I ended up having these other encounters with the law. And I had DUI, and I had a suspended license, and very stupidly was driving on it. And I violated the probation, and I had to do these 90 days. And so when I say nothing has made me feel more American, I think that we all know it's the kind of the great dark secret of American life that we incarcerate, 25% of the world's prisoners, more than China and Iraq and North Korea combined. Mm-hmm. And that the demographic of who we choose to incarcerate is very racially polarized. And I know all of this theoretically, and I've read about it and watched documentaries about it. But until the moment where I actually had to spend time in jail, I didn't really realize the actuality of that and how difficult it is once you kind of get enmeshed in the system to get yourself out, and how little possibility there is of rehabilitation or change. So all of these things hit home when I actually had to experience it firsthand. And I should mention that while this was happening, I was also going up for promotion as full professor at a university, Central Connecticut State in Connecticut. And so the media also got a hold of it, and it became this big news event in Connecticut, which also profoundly affected my life. So it's also about the role that media plays in the criminal justice system as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've read some things that you wrote about sort of like the racial makeup of the correctional facility that you were in, and that, how it was predominantly Black and Hispanic, and you were one of the few Asian Americans there. Can you talk a little bit about how, I guess I've seen your writings about sort of being the model minority, like what it means to be the model minority as an Asian American. And like, was that experience affected by being in that sort of racial makeup when you were in the correctional facility?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I was probably one of only one or two. There might have been another Filipino American, but I was actually, and much of what I thought jail would be was not what it was like. I mean, I wasn't in a cell. I was in a dorm with 60 other men, and there was a dorm on the other side, and we had these bunks that made up a cube, and so you kind of had to interact with your cube mates in a lot of ways. And but of those, in the two dorms, 120 men, I would say easily 90% were either African American or Hispanic American. And I found that race certainly on the inside, I was called all kind. Everyone had a shorthand or a nickname. And in fact, I came to find that that's a sense of how you would fit in. But, I was called everything from, Abu Dhabi to Bin Laden to India, when they found out I was a professor. I found that there was also, I think of the model minority myth, which was a term invented by a white sociologist, really, and is kind of used to mobilize Asian Americans against African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and erroneously, I think, because actually some new Asian immigrant populations are like the Cambodians and the Bhutanese, and are among the poorest. And so there's this great income gap. But many of the people that I met felt like, oh, okay, you have had benefited from far more privilege than I have, which was certainly true in my case. But I also had experienced a similar kind of discrimination based on the fact that I inhabited a brown body, and especially after 9/11 was seen exceedingly as a threat. And so, I feel like this book and my position is an interesting one because I really straddled both sides of that world. I was both unlike the men that were around me, and I was also deeply like them. And that's kind of the territory the book explores.
Yeah, that is such an interesting nuance that you're talking about, the sort of that growing up with privilege, especially compared to the type of people that you were in the correctional facility with, doesn't protect you from racial profiling, doesn't protect you from, you know, the kind of treatment that you had from the police, you know, that was unfair. So you're sort of both dealing with the same thing, but from like very different life standpoints.
Right.
I would love to know how the time you spent in jail changed the direction of your work as a writer. I mean, like correctional is obviously an example of a direction that you went, but I also know that you did a PhD in Sydney. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, when this happened to me, and it was, you know, in the midst of a very successful career as an academic and a writer, all of a sudden I had these encounters with the law that for reasons I didn't really understand. And the correctional is my grappling with why I could have kind of destroyed my job, and my marriage also fell apart, and my family. Mm-hmm. And after that, I actually ended up resigning my position at Central. It was a union position, and nothing I'd done really affected my teaching, and I could have stayed and fought for my job, but it had become a toxic place. And so I wanted to work on this book, and at the University of Sydney, I got this a wonderful opportunity to be an international research fellow and work on a doctorate, and which included critical writing. And so I undertook an exploration of prison memoirs by American men of color. I started really looking into the roots of mass incarceration, and when did it start getting racialized, kind of tracing it back to our Puritan forebears. And in fact, it was the Quakers who were kind of the left-wing party of their time who looked at prisons as a more humane alternative to what existed before then, which were the sanguinary punishments, public floggings and beatings, right, and executions. And so certainly, but they felt that silence and so solitary confinement very much comes out of that and work. And so there are a lot of exploitation of prison labor were rooted in the early ideals of the American prison. And I started looking at, it's no coincidence that the two great moments of explosion in prison growth in American history, one came after the Civil War in the post-Reconstructionist South, where there was this kind of prison to plantation pipeline that was created. Right. And the other one was right after the end of the civil rights movement in the 1970s with Ronald Reagan's war on drugs and President Clinton actually really exacerbating things with the crime bill that he put in. And so from 1980 to the time we're in now, I think the prison population went from something like 300,000 150,000 or so to 1.2 million or so, almost 1,000% increase during that time, which is, in a moment where we are experiencing the greatest kind of prosperity and wealth collectively as a society. So, I mean, I started really thinking about and looking at that. And, I also started reading prison writing. I mean, I didn't realize so much. Everything from John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress to Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy were written in prison. I guess the other thing that really happened was, and this is ongoing with the impending publication of the book, is that I felt like I needed to do something, that I wanted to create something not just literary, but make some pragmatic change. And so I have begun connecting with criminal justice reform organizations, and I have joined a theater group, And Still We Rise, based in Boston. It's composed of people who have been impacted by the criminal justice system, and they do performances. And so I actually had my acting debut last fall, which was fun, but I also connected with a gardener, Garden Time, that brings gardening skills into incarceral facilities. And I've been running writing workshops. And so I think this is work I hope that I might have been doing, but I certainly know not to this degree. And so the time that I spent, there's this great Japanese concept of wabi-sabi, right? Which is when you're making a pot in Japanese ceramics and it might crack, we might think of it as ruined, but there they inlay that crack with gold and call attention to it, and it becomes worth even more. And that idea that, you know, I love that the scar is somehow the source of the beauty. And so having kind of gone through the most terrible time of my life, the reverberations of which I'm still dealing with, I really feel like, okay, well, it's a blessing in disguise, because I encountered these men I never would have met. They shared their stories with me. I made a promise to these men that they said, you have a voice and we don't, you know, I want you to share our stories. And so I felt like I needed to, meet that obligation. And so all of that, I think, has been good in the midst of the carnage of what happened, really positive kinds of green shoots, I suppose.
I wonder how you feel about, things that have been happening in the news in the last year since last summer. I feel like there's much more talk about incarceration and mass incarceration and how it affects people of color, especially. Like, do you feel like things have changed a lot, at least in the conversation since you were incarcerated?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I've been working on this book for quite some time, and it really, unfortunately, took the murder of George Floyd for people to really... because the statistics about mass incarceration should have really had us protesting on the streets long ago. but I think that it has punctured public consciousness. But I'm old enough to remember a similar kind of feeling when Rodney King was beaten and Abner Louima. And so it does feel like, okay, we're on this precipice of something really happening. But so much of that is bound up with our politicians and with legislation. I do think that the conversation is shifting, and there is much more awareness, and I'm hopeful that this can be the moment of a sea change. But like I said, I've been hopeful before.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly hope so as well. One of the aspects of, I think you said it was part of your PhD thesis, but that I've seen in your other writing as well, is this idea of how incarceration or the criminal justice system is sort of tied up in our need to like shame people or like that comes from a puritanical background. And I think that that's so interesting, and also something that is not talked about a lot in terms of how, you know, people who come out of the criminal justice system are often not very employable. And is there like a real legitimate reason for that? Or is it just based around sort of shaming and embarrassing people and excluding them?
Yeah. You know, my partner does a lot of work on bibliotherapy and shame. And in fact, you know, if we think about the Scarlet Letter, right, Nathaniel Hawthorne's, a lot of times it's the difference between guilt and shame. I mean, a guilt is something that you can atone for, but shame is something you are, in fact, a criminal. And so it's displayed on your body. And that impulse, I think, did not go away when we created prisons. And I think we should think about, are prisons meant to be places to punish people, or are we trying to help people better reintegrate and equip them with the skills to reintegrate into society? The other principle I kind of explore in my exegesis is the influence of Calvinism. And this idea of the predetermination of the elect, which I think still really holds sway. And this idea that if you had wealth, it was a sign that you were part of God's chosen. And those who did not, in fact, it was their station in life was justifiable in some way. And I think that that sense has led people to, once you've paid your debt to society, you should be able to be employed. But I have been helping and talked to so many people for whom it is a life sentence. They might have had a minor offense as a youth, and after that, they couldn't hold down a steady job, and they had a family to provide for. And so it's not surprising that they end back up in institutions like prison. And so I think it's really incumbent upon us. So very easily, I think we kind of dismiss people who've done a crime without thinking empathetically about what it means for our society. And in fact, it's costing us economically and socially so much money to continue this policy that doesn't really break. I mean, I also mentioned that the rates of recidivism in the U.S. are really high compared to the rest of the developed world. And so why is it? Why are we funding this kind of broken system? And is it to actually enforce these unspoken about social imperatives and to propagate systems like racism? I think if we look closely, that might be the case.
Yeah, there was something you mentioned about a sort of like New England brand of puritanicalism, or sort of a, you know, I think those of us who live in New England, I include myself in this, you know, think that we don't have as many problems with racism as, for example, the South or something like that. But would you talk a little bit about how it's still present here, but it's just sort of under the radar, sort of, you know, boiling under?
Yeah. You know, I grew up in Virginia, which I didn't even, Northern Virginia, which I didn't even realize was south of the Mason-Dixon line until I got to UVA and I saw people flying the Confederate flag. Mm. What about Southern racism? I feel it's overt. It's kind of in your face. Right. And you know where you stand. The insidious thing about racism in New England is that it is kind of in the institutions. No one talks about it. The statistic I bring up in the memoir is Connecticut is perpetually one of the top two or three richest states in the country per capita. And yet over 30% of the population in the inner cities of Hartford and Bridgeport, New Haven live below the poverty line, and they're communities of color primarily. And this is something that is not spoken about. There's this very Robert Frost, good fences make good neighbors kind of reserve. And so, you know, it would be unseemly to talk about it because, you know, we have a Democratic governor and we are, you know, staunchly liberal. And, you know, and I also think there is a certain condescension I found when it came to the liberal sensibility of some of my really well-intentioned friends when they kind of talk about communities of color. And I think it's because they probably haven't really been exposed to communities of color. And so they have these ideas that could probably be challenged.
Yeah, I also think, the Common is part of Amherst College, which is very much a racially diverse college now, but certainly was not up until, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago or something like that. And I think that a lot of the racial diversity we have in our area comes from having these world-class colleges and universities that do bring in students from all over and students from all backgrounds, but I don't think it's really inherent to this area. Mm-hmm. So if we can switch gears, I just noticed looking at your bio that it seems like you've done a lot of work in collaboration with other writers, which I think is not terribly common. So I wondered if you would talk a little bit about what that process is like. You know, are there things that you can achieve in collaboration that don't happen when you're working on your own?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, in fact, even when I think about this memoir, that, you know, the number of voices that gave me feedback and editors who worked on it, I mean, there's always a collaborator. I was just recently thinking of, you know, Nelson Mandela's autobiography, which he wrote in prison when he was doing 27 years. And a kind of footnote to that is Mac Maharaj, who was his person of Indian origin who transcribed and smuggled out this book into history, right? So there's always this idea of collaborators. I found I had one book in particular, What Else Could It Be, where I collaborated with a number of different writers, everyone from Jim Daniels to Eileen Miles to Camille Dungy, Alvin Pang, a Singaporean writer. And I might be tone deaf. I think I have a sense of rhythm, but it's the closest I'll ever come to feeling like a jazz musician. And when it is really working, I think this really exciting thing happens. And there's a third voice that emerges. It's not mm-hmm. your own. It's not the other writers. But somehow in the coming together, this thing happens. And I've also worked on a lot of anthologies. You mentioned The Language for a New Century, which my co-editors, Tina Chang and Natalie Handel, were wonderful. And it really, you know, it was our ideas in dialogue and in conversation that helped shape this book, which I think is still probably the most comprehensive collection of contemporary South Asian, East Asian, and Middle Eastern poetry today. I feel like I'm part of it when you collaborate, of course, also is that, you know, half the work is done for you. So, you know, that, I say that kind of facetiously, of course, but I'm really excited by the newness of what it's like to inhabit someone else's mind, because other writers and other thinkers, I've actually also done stuff with visual artists and musicians on occasion, and what it does to transform your own sensibility is pretty extraordinary, because the direction the work goes is often very surprising. And I find that the richest work happens in that space.
I also know you've done some translation, and I think, you know, I've talked to other translators in the podcast, and it definitely seems like it can be a very collaborative process, but I'm not sure. I mean, I think that some of the translation you've done hasn't been necessarily with living poets. Have you done any sort of collaborative translation?
I actually have. I worked with a Japanese poet, Yuki Nagai, on her translation. So she's a performance poet, and we did a workshop in Tokyo. And of course, her English is much better than my kanji. So she was able to kind of put her words into the basic English foxtrot. And we talked about it, and I was able to then help bring it into English. And I think she's a really extraordinary poet. But the book that I worked on, my mother tongue is Tamil. That's the language my parents speak. And there is this figure, this goddess, Andal, who lived in the 8th century. And she's the only female saint of the 12 Vaishnavite saints, the 12 saints of Vishnu in South India. And she wrote or composed all of this work before the age of about 14 or so, when she apparently disappeared. And no one knows really what happened to her. And her poems are still recited at South Indian weddings today. And so when I met Priya Sarukai Chabria, Indian writer, at a festival in India, and we started talking, and we realized we had this figure in common who's huge in India, but really not known at all in the West. I think people might know Mirabai, who is another Bhakti poet of the North, but Andal had only been translated in a scholarly version and not really well. And so Priya and I undertook this book, The Autobiography of a Goddess, which is published by Zubon, a great feminist press in India, and University of Chicago Press in the US. And the interesting thing about this translation was that because she lived in India and I was in New York at the time, we worked on the initial part of the translation, and then we separated and worked on the translation separately. And then when we got back together, we shared them. And the work was so distinct that we decided in the book to include both my translations and her translations of the same poems, so that it's almost kind of kaleidoscopically getting through both versions, maybe closer to the original. And then we also included some translations that we worked on collaboratively. And so that idea, I think, really came out of the work that we did together. I think Andal, she's kind of a South Indian Rumi, and really she's a Bhakti poet. Bhakti is the notion of diving deep. And so her poems are very sensual, and yet the thing that she longs for is the transcendent. And that tension, I think, is really amazing.
I'm so glad you talked about that book, because I was going to ask you about it. It just, you know, I had not heard of this character before, and she just sounds so fascinating to me. The idea of being sort of a real person who really existed and really wrote poetry, but also this sort of mythological figure, you know, being sainted and everything. I'm going to have to get the book. I have to ask you, you share your name with the very famous sitarist Ravi Shankar. And I have known about him since I was a little kid, because as a child, I was very obsessed with the Beatles. And obviously, the Beatles collaborated with him. So I was just wondering, could you talk a little bit about, you know, is that a common name? Is it strange for you? I know you eulogized him in the I think the New York Times when he passed away.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. The one thing I'll mention first is that naming conventions in India are quite different. And so my father, for example, his name is K.H. Shankar, which is Kaudampakkalam Harihan Shankar. And Kaudampakkalam is the village that he came from. Harihan is really his given name, and his family name, and Shankar was his given name. And so I was named Ravi Shankar because I was born in January, and in South India, there's a festival of harvest called Pongal. And Ravi in Sanskrit means sun. And so that's why I was kind of given that name. So it was utter coincidence. My parents weren't even music fans. I think my mom might have liked John Denver a little bit, but there was no ragas being played at my house. It was just kind of a coincidence. And then certainly from as early as I can remember, there was this connection that was being made. It's less so now, but certainly at least once a week, someone would react with either amusement or bemusement or disappointment at the, ask me, if I had been at Woodstock or later if Nora Jones was my daughter. And so it was a strange thing to live with a name that was someone who was more famous. And I wanted to very much interview him, and I was meant to in Boston one time, and he fell ill and I wasn't able to. But it made me think of the capricious nature of names in general. And, there was a part, I detail in this essay a couple of experiences I did when I was in New York. I got invited to this very fancy party, and a gilt-edged invitation was delivered to my door of my dingy Brooklyn walk-up, and clearly meant for the other Ravi Shankar. And I went and, ate lobster canapes at with Roberto Colasso. And on the other side, I was at a little reading at the Carborough Poetry Festival, and it was mainly a kind of elderly crowd that was there to see me. And I got up, they introduced me, and I start reading my poems, and this elderly man stands up and he points his cane at me and he says, "That's not Ravi Shankar." And he turns back around to everyone and says, "This guy's an imposter." And slowly, and because they were all elderly, it took like what seemed like forever, they all departed in their walkers and wheelchairs and turned around and left the room, leaving me with like two people in the audience. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, I've had all sides of that. I like to say it's my great curse and blessing.
Well, yes. And I think you wrote somewhere that you are the third most famous Ravi Shankar. Is that right?
There's Sri Ravi Shankar of the Art of Living is a mm-hmm. spiritual guru with devotees worldwide. Yeah.
Yeah. It strikes me as very, very interesting. I have one last question, which is just what you're working on now. Like, what's next from you? Is it back to poetry?
Constitutionally, I'm a poet. You never really mm-hmm. stop working on poems, but I'm really in October, Correctional will be out, and we're starting to set up readings, and I'll be doing promotion for that. Mm-hmm. But I feel like now I really want to, write some speculative fiction or a detective story or something. I mean, certainly I've grown very tired of myself. I do have a book of poems where I'm trying to bring Asian forms into the English language. I mean, I think the ghazal has kind of made it in. Of course, people know about haiku, but there are so many forms that are as iconic and interesting as a sonnet or a villanelle. And in the Rig Veda itself, there are hundreds of poetic forms. And so I've started writing English versions of that. And that's kind of a longer term project.
Oh, wow. Well, that all sounds very, very interesting. Ravi Shankar, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great to talk with you.
It's been a real pleasure, and keep up the great work at The Common.
It's our pleasure to do that work. Listeners, you can read Ravi's essay and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.